Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. That's on your radio dial, as well as streaming online at citr.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Welcome, everybody. We have a great show today. In fact, before we begin, I just have to say, it has been absolutely beautiful out the last couple of days here in Vancouver. The sun has been shining. It's been a warm, balmy 10 degrees. And, you know, a bit of rain here and there, sure, a bit overcast every now and then. But by and large, I mean, it is almost spring. It is fantastic. So I don't know what the future holds for us. I mean, summer is eventually coming. But the whole point being is, right now, we're getting some beautiful weather here in Vancouver. And it's just really funny because everywhere else, it's like snowing so much. You know, there's like 19 feet of snow on the East Coast. So really, the most important thing right now is that if you have relatives who live somewhere else, really rub it in right now. Like really just twist the knife and get a picture of yourself outside next to the pool with sunglasses on. Because it's just too good to pass up. I mean, this weather is fantastic. And I hope that you've gotten outside to enjoy it a little bit. But enough about me going on about the weather. It is time to talk about the sector and what's going on here on the show. And some interesting topics today. We're going to focus on a couple different things. I want to talk a bit about CITR, the radio station, of course, which is, in fact, a nonprofit and charity. And CITR's Fund Drive is coming up in the next week. And so I'll tell you a bit about what Fund Drive is and why supporting CITR is a really good decision that you can make, especially for supporting things like social justice, activism, and progressive politics. But there's a few interesting news stories that have been going around that I want to touch on, all relating, of course, to our mandate here on the show. One of them is about a generational gap for giving to charity, and this should come as really no surprise. It's not going to be all that shocking that the baby boomer generation gives a bit more to charity than, say, Gen Y. But examining this information, we can take a look at where those differences are happening and perhaps even understand a little bit about why some of those differences are happening. Charities in the future are going to have to figure out a way to navigate this to a certain degree. The baby boomer generation is not going to be around forever, unfortunately, and it's a question of how do we get the new generations of folks, some of whom, you know, don't exactly have all the financial security that they would hope to have, but nevertheless, how do we get these new generations on board with charitable giving and focus them on causes that really matter? Of course, causes that really matter is going to be a trend for debate in the upcoming years. But I mean, it is an interesting idea to think about, are there generational causes? And do we need to kind of wean people onto them or off of them, maybe? Or maybe it's time for sort of a paradigm shift and we start focusing on different things. Healthcare, children, and disease is usually one of the high points of any sort of charitable giving pathos amongst most people. But we're beginning to see things like education and the environment and social welfare. These priorities are becoming more and more pronounced. And ultimately, they're starting to kind of challenge the more established framework. Is that good or bad? I mean, we don't know yet. So we'll take a look at a report out of the Wall Street Journal on that. Later on, I want to talk a bit about, some sort of sad news, depending on how you look at things. The death of Sun News. Yes, it is the conservative right-wing media empire here in Canada. Sun News has fallen. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. And so we'll you know, talk about that and maybe make a few jokes. We'll see how it goes. And then I want to talk a bit about a recent news item that's been making the rounds here locally in Canada. Well, and hopefully around the world too. This notion of how we see activists. Do we see them as a public nuisance? Do we see them as a viable and important part of civil discussion? Recently, a RCMP memo or security report was leaked and suggesting that the anti-petroleum movement was a growing security threat. So We've actually kind of touched on this in the past, but we'll dive into it a bit more in today's episode. Now, before we take a quick break here on the sector, there is one other thing I wanted to share with you all. I recently found this website called Poet Tweet, where it takes your tweets from Twitter and compiles them into a poem. Now, it's really interesting because it just sort of takes various bits and pieces of your tweets and structures them in a way to sort of make them rhyme sometimes. And you can create different kinds of poems like sonnets and whatnot. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. I've been playing around with it for quite a bit and gotten quite a good laugh out of it. So I wanted to share with you all now a poem based on my tweets, a sonnet actually. And I'll give you the link and show notes where you can go check it out and make your own poems. But without further ado, I present to you With Wow by Ethan Clow. News, theories, and social justice. Over beers with the team. Austere and gravitas having voice. Of gold, every nonprofit's dream. What the holidays are all about. What the holidays are all about. Charity bashing and CRA audits. Episode 2 of the Check It Out. Return on investments for nonprofits. You are irresistible job candidate. Government. Types of porn they've banned. At 1 p.m. on the Canadian Senate. What? Drown out a playable race? Abused in their children's homes. Did it wow. Moves on to face. Well, there you have it. A particularly ridiculous poem created by my tweets. And as I said, they're quite silly, but they're also quite fun. So I do encourage you to check it out and marvel at your ability to create found poems. Anyway, let's take a quick break here on the sector. We will return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, on the sector. Now, speaking of CITR, it is time to discuss CITR's annual fund drive. This year, it's happening from February the 26th to March 6th. And they're aiming to raise $40,000 in pledges and donations to help support the station. This year's theme is Let's Get Digital. And that's not just because it's a snappy slogan, it actually has some meaning. This year, CITR is raising funds for two different projects. One is to build a new website for CITR, and if you have visited our website at citr.ca, you will know that that is absolutely 100% needed. Because in this new age of websites and computers and technology, an adaptive website is kind of important, and ours is a bit outdated. It's a bit, I don't know, what's the word? It's a bit 1999-ish? Well, anyway, that's one of the big projects for CITR. The other is Discorder, the organization's magazine, which has been ongoing for many years and features articles about upcoming bands and interesting activities here in Vancouver from sort of a musical point of view. It's got a lot of valid aspects to it that I think anyone who's sort of interested in kind of like underground music and independent radio and, you know, that kind of cool stuff, you'd be really supportive of Discorder. Now, of course, the ultimate thing, of course, is to support the station. This is the only time that CITR asks for support from our listening audience. And it's a great opportunity for you to kick in a bit of, maybe a few bucks here and there, $10, $30, $100. And it really helps make a difference in turning the station into something that produces great content. You know, there's not a lot of independent radio stations in Canada. Very few in Vancouver. CITR is one of the only a handful. And without that support, this station couldn't really survive. And it's been around for a really long time. We'd like to make sure that it stays around for a really long time. Not just for shows like The Sector or my old show Radio Free Thinker, but for all the future content that's going to be produced on the station. It's a great place for students to, you know, learn the chops about radio programming. It's a great place to get the word out there for important things like activism, social justice, that kind of thing. I mean, ultimately, of course, it makes a huge difference in the quality of the radio and the quality of the offerings at CITR. This new website is going to be fantastic. It's going to allow people to move between CITR and Discorder, to, you know, liaison between the print and the audio side of things. You'll be able to search for your favorite bands and your news topics and discover related podcasts, audio segments, interviews, photos, all that kind of stuff. It's going to be all amalgamated together. It's going to be fantastic. Additionally, it will allow programmers here at CITR, people like me, to have a much more easier interface when we produce our content. So we'll be able to link things together really easily in terms of like interviews, articles written in Discorder, events, that kind of thing. So we won't have to say, you know, go and follow all these complicated links. It'll be all together in one easy package. You know, it's a great system to have and something that we've been able to sort of make on our own just by kind of, you know, elbow grease, that sort of thing. But with this, we'll be able to actually create that platform, and you, the listener, will benefit because we'll be able to provide you with that much more content. CITR is also launching a reel-to-reel collection. This is really fascinating. CITR is digitizing all the broadcast material from the over, you know, 60 years that it's been in operation. So that's about 900-plus audio reels, and it's a lot of work. They're about halfway through it so far, and we really need some support to get all the way. There's a really big collection of music, radio documentaries, current affairs, live broadcasts. There's stuff of really valuable historic content, and I've actually had a chance to look at some of this stuff. It's really amazing. You know, some of the people that we've interviewed over the years, not just like not me, but people at CITR, they've really touched on a lot of movers and shakers, important topics. It's got a lot of historic value, and I think that, you know, going back and listening to it would be a real treat. So anyway, that's some of the stuff that I wanted to hype up about FunDrive. It's happening again next week. Now, I will be producing a special FunDrive episode with my pal Don over at Radio Free Thinker. We're going to do sort of like a combined episode Tuesday at 3 o'clock. So we're not going to do a regular Sector podcast episode that week. We're just going to have sort of a combination show. And that will, of course, happen Tuesday at 3 o'clock. You'll be able to call in to CITR and make pledges and donations. You'll be able to donate online. I'll have all that linkage in the show notes at sectorpodcast.wordpress.ca. And, of course, we'll encourage you to tune in and listen, and it'll be a great time, as always. Me and Don always have a blast when we broadcast together. Well, let's move on with our next topic here on The Sector. Well, talking about the generational gap. This is an article that was published in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, but it's something that's kind of interesting that I wanted to share with you, our listeners, and perhaps provoke a bit of discussion. So the article talks a bit about giving to charity. And of course, you know, Christmas was only, well, a couple of months, a month and a half ago, let's say. Let's go with that. And as always, Americans were rushing to give to their favorite charities, as were Canadians, of course. But this article is more focused on the American side of things. Now, what it asks is, how does giving differ from generation to generation? There was a recent poll by Harris titled Money, Time, Blood, What Are Americans Giving? And it looked at a couple different stats. Overall, 9 in 10 Americans, 91%, have made some sort of contribution within the past 2 or 3 years to charity. The top types of giving are This is what kind of thing they're giving, not where they're giving. So the top three are used clothing at 73%, money at 66%, and food at 53%. I'm not sure if they're differentiating between money gives for food or food period. I'm guessing it's simply food. Rounding out the bottom of that list, 18% gave blood as their charitable donation. Some of the interesting findings indicate that older adults are twice as likely as young adults to want charities to focus their effort on disaster relief. Young adults want to give more weight to education and global health. They also say that young adults are slightly more idealistic. Almost 3 in 10 millennials, ages 18 to 37, believe people have a personal responsibility to make the world a better place by actively being involved with various issues and causes, compared to only 24% of the baby boomers, ages 50 to 68, and 24% of the matures, age 69 plus. So that's a little bit interesting in terms of the perceived responsibility of making the world a better place. I'm a little bit intrigued by that because here in Canada, at least, most of the giving is dictated by the baby boomer generation, the so-called 50s to 68s, although I think that those age brackets could be a bit different. Anyway, the point being, though, is that the bulk of charitable giving has been from that generation, at least for the time being. And it's not exactly been wasted money, of course. It's been funneled into things like hospitals, healthcare, disease research, looking after children, that sort of thing. So that's an interesting way of looking at things from the point of view of, you know, do you have a personal responsibility to give? Maybe that's an American perspective. I don't know. Now, there's the published infographic that goes along with this article in the Wall Street Journal. And of course, we'll link this in our show notes. So if you look at the social responsibility section, it asks the different generations, how they view certain questions. What attitude about personal involvement in civic community and social issues should people have? For the millennials, interestingly enough, 29% said that people have a personal responsibility to make the world a better place by being involved with various issues and causes. Now, only 22% in the Gen Xers had that position, 24% in the baby boomers, and 24% in the matures. So right there, that's not a big difference at all. That's a 1% or so difference, really. I mean, 29 to 24, okay, so a 5% difference. But that's not huge. That's not like a major deviance or something. For the question of, or well, the statement regarding people generally should take part in such things because it's the right thing to do, 19% of millennials believe that to be true, 17% of Gen Xers, 17% of baby boomers, 18% of matures. Again, very little difference. A margin of 3% separates that belief. The belief that people can get involved with different causes if they want to, but no one should feel obligated to do so. 40% of millennials, 49% of Gen Xers, 53% of baby boomers, and 56% of matures. So that's actually sizably different. That, I think, is interesting. That's a whole 10% from millennials to baby boomers, well, plus 10% and change, and even almost 10% in Gen Xers. That, I think, is more telling than anything else. That has some pretty interesting ramifications, I think, on this idea of responsibility, of it's not simply a question of do you want to get involved, it's a question of should you get involved. Interestingly, a person's main concern is to look out for his or her own interests, not to be involved with social causes. 6% of millennials hold that view, 5% of Gen Xers, 2% of baby boomers, and 1% of matures. So that's also quite interesting. That, I guess, could speak to kind of a more entitled point of view. And again, that declines with age, not increases. So that's also striking. Now, when you look at the top priorities for the different generational groups, the highest priority for millennials is listed at education for 20%. Now, interestingly enough, the baby boomers rate that at 12%, which is not their lowest. The highest for baby boomers is actually, there's two different things: disaster relief at 16%, and youth and families at 16%. Millennials rate youth and family at 15%, and they rate disaster relief at 6%, which is one of the lower ones for millennials. Now, one of the lowest ones for the baby boomer generation is animals at 4%. Poor animals. Millennials also keep animals low at 5%, and that's also one of the lowest. So, you know, the differences are not really that pronounced. I mean, with the possible exception of education, from, you know, 20 to 12, which is fairly large, almost 10, you know, things like human rights are not that different. 12% for millennials, 11% for baby boomers. Medical research is a bit lower on the millennial side, 8% to 11 for the baby boomers. Disaster relief is probably one of the bigger breakaways. So 6% for millennials, 16% for baby boomers. Again, about 10% difference. The environment is 8% for millennials, 6% for baby boomers. Not a big gap there. So, you know, it's interesting because it does show that while there are a few key differences, they're not as pronounced as one might expect. So what does that mean? Well, maybe it means that giving is not something that's as different as we like to think it is. The urge to give to charity appears to be fairly strong. The causes that motivate us probably have more to do with what is being promoted and what is being talked about in the news and media and social circles, and probably less to do with something about to do with age. Chances are it's more about priorities that are presented to you, and this would indicate that that's more likely the case than not. So, interesting takeaways from that. Why don't we take a quick break here on The Sector? We will return after this.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
Hello and welcome back to The Sector here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver with me, Ethan Clow. Well, speaking of the changing media network in Canada, the conservative media empire Sun News has officially closed as of February 13th, 2015. Now, you won't see me shedding a tear for this conservative pundit opinion gas bag of a radio station, or pardon me, news media outlet, but It is kind of interesting to talk a little bit about the collapse of Sun Media and sort of what this means for the kind of broader Canadian communication landscape. Now, the general argument against Sun News, of course, was that it was a channel that basically had a political agenda focused against things like progressive politics, liberalism, the CBC, and in general, just kind of a lot of the things out here on the sector that we talk about and respect and enjoy. So it's good that it's gone, but it's also interesting to kind of look at what led to its demise. Now, there's some interesting theories on that. One thing that I think is very interesting is that Sun News completely and totally underestimated the intelligence of the Canadian public. And they underestimated what the Canadian public's tolerance for of kind of Fox News style propaganda reporting would be. In an article on the TAI, they talked about the lack of intelligence behind Sun Media, the presentation of information that essentially took the Canadian public as some kind of idiot. And I'd like to look at a couple examples, and I'll post a link in our show notes where you can follow up with the actual article itself. But they pointed out a couple really interesting examples of this. There was an incident with a train explosion in Lac Minec, where host Ezra Levant had a fellow on, Greg Renoff, a blogger who tends to harangue protesters, and who speculated that the town was incinerated by eco-radicals who objected to transport of oil by rail. There was the time when host Brian Lilly fingered young Guelph conservative communications worker Michael Sona as the sole mastermind behind the robocalls election fraud. Now, of course, this whole affair, the whole robocalls thing, clearly was not the work of one person, a sole mastermind, but a setup directed by the Prime Minister's office. Michael Corrin, the resident anti-choice anchor, and I've actually met Michael Corrin. I've been on his show a couple times back when I was working with CFI. But obviously his big thing was abortion and was known to extremely exaggerate and distort findings about abortion rates, how many so-called newborns terminated by abortion attempts, et cetera, et cetera. Michael Corrin is an interesting case because I remember he obviously had this sort of Catholic point of view, this bias about against abortion and gay rights and all this nonsense. But surprisingly, he was also quite happy to wag his finger at anti-vax proponents. And I remember speaking with him about that. It was always very strange to hear someone talk intelligently about how terrible the anti-vax movement was, and then in his next segment talk about how abortion was destroying the fabric of society. It was just a really weird dichotomy. Anyway, so those are a couple of examples of how Sun News really sort of underestimated the intelligence of the Canadian public. When you think about the way that news is reported in Canada, many of us, I think, have a perception of a very sort of unbiased and politically neutral tone. This, I think, is kind of set by the benchmark of like the CBC, where we don't expect to have a kind of raving lunatic froth at the mouth and tell us how we're all going to hell because of abortion or gay marriage or something like that. That's kind of the domain of Fox News, and even to a different extent, the kind of politicized news media in the States. You always sort of expect to see a political backbencher, it's sort of like somebody who can be the Homer for a political party in the States, whether that's Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert or someone on MSNBC or whatever. There's always that sense that there has to be a political motivation for why you're reporting this. This notion that news can't simply be neutral. It has to be motivated or inflamed or informed by a political bias, and that there is a reason for reporting on this. That's something that I think in the last maybe 10 years, we're seeing a bit of a shift in Canada, but Sun News took that to the utmost extreme. Sun News became a poster child for the right outstanding honorable Canadian citizen, you know, a God-fearing, conservative, patriotic, blah, 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 Canadian. And they couldn't help but take shots at the CBC or left-wing media. And what this, I think, did for a lot of Canadians is that they kind of said, well, A, I don't think you're right. I don't think what you're saying is correct. And I've mentioned a few examples earlier. But they also sort of said, listen, I don't like being talked to in this way. I don't need you to tell me how to interpret information. I'm smart enough to figure this thing out on my own. And again, with Sun News, they were just more than happy to preach from the pulpit of this soapbox, talking down to Canadians. And the Canadians themselves, we good folk here in Canada, our response was often, well, I don't need you to color the news politically. I can do that on my own. I'm not an idiot here. You know, I know what's going on. I'm able to see through the bullshit, and I'm able to see through all the crap that you're putting in here to color this as either morally upstanding or degenerate filth. That's easy enough for us Canadians to figure on our own. And I think that when you look at the way that the Harper government has made major cutbacks to the CBC, has limited the CBC's ability to produce good content, and you look at the sort of changing business world around Canada, a really good example is the CBC losing hockey, that going to Rogers Media. And that's the first time in Canadian history that our national sport is not being broadcast by our national broadcaster. You look at all these things that have been happening to the CBC and the way that they've been facing cutbacks and layoffs and a hostile media industry. And yet, I think that Canadians, more often than not, would rather tune to the CBC to get their news than Sun Media or any other news media source because it's trusted. It's got a reputation. And that is a hard-earned thing, which is something that Sun News took for granted. They treated their audience like idiots, and they were willing to cater to the lowest common denominator, and people saw through it. They saw through that crap. And that's why Sun News has lost millions of dollars and has failed miserably. So what does this all mean for, you know, regular good old reporting news in Canada? It's good news. It means that Canadians have rejected crappy reporting and that hopefully news media companies in the future will keep that in mind when they produce more content. But it's also interesting news, I think, for the good providers of news, for the people who work hard and create a politically neutral program, a source of news and commentary, that the Canadian public is hungry for that. And sooner or later, I think that that will be respected once again in Canada when we have a different sort of political force and power. Well, to wash out all that annoying Sun News media story, we're going to take a musical interlude here on The Sector. I have a song here I want to play. This is, of course, by the band Interpol off their newish album, El Pintor, which was released in last September. And I think when it was, I played a song or two off of it a couple of months ago. So here's another one. This one is called Tidal Wave. Enjoy.
BC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Class, shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we are back here on The Sector on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. So before the break, I just played a musical interlude that was Tidal Wave by Interpol. And you can find that song on their album El Pintor, which is available wherever quality records are sold. Just a reminder, if you want to participate in The Sector, send us your comments, your thoughts, your criticisms, or your concerns, we'd be happy to hear from you. And I just noticed I'm saying the word we instead of I, but whatever. I or we would be happy to hear from you. So you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can find our show notes and the podcast, of course, at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And if you want to tweet us or follow us on Facebook, those options are available. You can tweet us at Sector Podcast, or you can tweet me, you know, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow on Twitter. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And if you want to get a hold of us for any reason, we're more than happy to hear from you. Now, moving on with the show, I mentioned at the top that there was a memo, a leaked article regarding the RCMP and how they see the anti-petroleum protesting movement, as we say. Now, this is always kind of interesting to talk about how authority figures see activists, how they see protesters, how they see social justice movements. In this particular case, it's not all that hopeful the way that the RCMP are perceiving the anti-petroleum movement. The article in question that I get my information from is in the Globe and Mail. I will have a link to it in our show notes. In it, it recounts how the RCMP labeled the anti-petroleum movement, which I assume is environmentalists, as a growing and violent threat to Canada's security, which not only raises the question of how are they defining Canadian security, but also highlighting a fear that environmentalists will be faced with surveillance, privacy intrusions, and possibly worse, the article notes, under the Harper government's new terrorism legislation. Now, this all, I think, brings in a lot of different threads of conversation that we've been having here on The Sector. When Gareth Kirkby was on a few weeks ago, we talked about the changing rhetoric in Canada, from the Harper government all the way through the different channels of communication to the public, through media, etc. Changing the way that we talk about protesters, civil disobedience, and raising concerns about the environment, or really kind of any other policy issue that the government opposes the protesters' viewpoint on. This radicalization of rhetoric has given the impression that not only are environmentalists eco-terrorists, they're crazy mental cases who represent a violent threat to Canadian security. Now, again, all of this is taken with really no skeptical scrutiny whatsoever. There's no evidence at all that environmentalists are a threat to Canadian security. In fact, if we're talking about threats to Canadian security, there are so many other things that we could be talking about in terms of actual evidence-inspired threats that we should be looking at and keeping an eye on, the least of those are people who are protesting the oil sands. In a quote from the article, it states, "There is a growing, highly organized, well-financed, anti-Canadian petroleum movement that consists of peaceful activists, militants, and violent extremists who are opposed to society's reliance on fossil fuels." Now, aside from the fact that that's a horribly grammatically worded sentence, there's a lot of things to unpack there. First of all, a highly organized and well-financed anti-Canadian movement is something of an oxymoron when it comes to activists, as we all know. Highly organized? I don't know. Is the environmental movement in Canada highly organized? I would say no, it's not. And this is not a criticism. Well, I mean, it is. It's not meant to be a put-down. It's meant to be looking at the objective reality. I don't know that our environmental movement is all that effectively organized. Maybe this is something that, if you're more involved in that particular field, you could let me know on. But from my point of view, it doesn't look all that organized. You have protesters in BC and Alberta on the oil sands. You have protesters about overfishing and pollution of rivers and dams. You have protesters who are focusing on the lumber industry. There doesn't seem to be a lot of cohesive cooperation that I know of. Second of all, well-financed? Really? Is the environmental movement all that well-financed? I mean, we were just talking about it at the top of the show about where money is getting donated to, and environmental charities are not exactly high up on that list. So that's an interesting question right there. I mean, how well-financed is the movement, and especially compared to the counter-movement? How well-financed is the oil industry? Pretty well-financed, if our evidence is to be believed. The fact that the oil industry has, in many cases, been able to create their own organizations, to create their own lobbying groups, they've been able to create arm's-length policy advisory groups that can do lobbying for them. I don't know. That all seems to suggest that it's not so much the environmental groups who are well-financed, but it's their opponents, these people who have billions of dollars of disposable income at their fingertips to ram through legislation in Canadian government. That seems more well-financed than the protesters who sit outside in tents. Anyway, anti-Canada. Now, again, I don't necessarily see these protesters as being anti-Canadian. I mean, are they running around with Union Jack flags? Are they running around with American flags? Are they running around with, let's say, Russian flags? No, they're not, really. They don't seem to be anti-Canadian at all. I mean, if anything, they're trying to protect the environmental legacy of things in Canada. That would probably make them patriots, wouldn't it? And then the most interesting thing about this, with regards to how they describe these Canadian protesters. Listen to this again. Well-financed anti-Canada petroleum movement that consists of peaceful activists, militants, and violent extremists who are opposed to society's reliance on fossil fuels. So, peaceful activists, militants, and violent extremists. Doesn't that make up the entire spectrum of all protesting? I mean, think about that for a second. Peaceful activists, militants, violent extremists. Those three groups make up any social movement whatsoever. Every social movement has those three groups in it. If you're a religious minority, you have those three groups in it. You have the terrorists and the people who blow up buildings. Those are the, you know, violent extremists. You have like the militants, the people who, you know, draw lines in the sand and will not waver whatsoever. And then you have the peaceful activists who go around and, you know, handle flyers. That's every movement. Now, the idea that they're sort of labeling that at the environmental movement is all the more curious because there hasn't been, as far as I know, very many violent explosions of environmental activism in Canada. What's also interesting about this is that these groups, these protesting groups, they often don't recognize the other portion of them. The peaceful activists don't tend to recognize the violent extremists as being legitimate members of their community. Likewise, the violent extremists, they don't look at peaceful protesters as, you know, pulling their weight, so to speak. It's not like these groups have all gotten together, like there's this big round table of peaceful activists on one side and violent extremists on the other, and they plan out strategy. That doesn't happen. You look at any social movement, again, religious movements, social movements, anti-racism, you know, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. All of these different groups, they didn't coexist. They had as much disagreement amongst themselves as they did with anyone else. You would never suggest that, you know, the biggest problem facing, say, America today is pro-Muslim groups. And pro-Muslim groups are made up of peaceful activists and violent extremists. No, no, you differentiate between the two. One of them is no threat. One of them is a big threat. Doesn't make sense to combine them. And this is coming from law enforcement, people. Anyway, look, moving on. The interesting thing about this is that it was obtained by Greenpeace. And that's interesting. I mean, I gave Greenpeace a pretty hard time a few episodes ago regarding the graffitiing of a cultural heritage site. But nevertheless, you know, good work by Greenpeace on this one. Certainly, it's possible to be absolutely brain dead on one topic and be a bit on the ball with something else. So, you know, good on Greenpeace for this. Getting back to the legislation, it identifies, quote, activity that undermines the security of Canada, and that is described as anything that interferes with the economic or financial stability of Canada or with the country's critical infrastructure. Now, what does all this mean? It's very vague. It's very open to interpretation, and that's not a good thing when it comes to legislation. You need to have specifics and details to understand what's illegal and what isn't. With this legislation, essentially, if you were to protest outside of a oil refinery, for instance, if you blocked the road, that could be considered a crime now. You could be labeled a terrorist for doing that. Like, that's the far-reaching consequences of such legislation, that somebody who is setting up a sign that says no more oil or whatever, whereas before, you could just kind of drag them to the side of the road, you know, peacefully. That's what law enforcement would do. Now those people are being arrested as, like, eco-terrorists. Even if you don't approve of those methods, even if you don't agree with their stance, is that the kind of Canada that we want? Do we want to have these people carted off as criminals, as terrorists? I mean, is that the Canada that we want to live in? I don't know. Sounds pretty awful to me. You know, this, of course, is only one tip of the iceberg with regards to this legislation. It can really be applied to so many other areas. And that's, of course, the big concern by a lot of civil liberties organizations. The BC Civil Liberties Association and others are investigating this, trying to, you know, take this to court and really examine this under a microscope. But again, you look at, like, where could this be applied to? You could really take this and run with it if you wanted to. It doesn't have to be about climate change. Never mind the fact that basically what this is essentially saying is that anyone who is concerned about climate change is a potential, if not an actual, eco-terrorist. This could really be swept into other areas where protesting against a government policy could be considered un-Canadian. It could be terrorism activities. You know, protesting the Harper's treatment of war veterans could become terrorism. There's really no limit to who could be labeled a terrorist because the wording of this legislation is so vague. I mean, anybody who is found being un-Canadian, protesting something, threatening, in quotation marks, Canadian security, well, that could be anything. You haven't defined what those concepts are. All we know is that if you in some way inhibit Canada's economy, if you some way inhibit Canada's reliance on fossil fuels, that in of itself becomes a terrorist act. What does that tell us about other forms of civil disobedience, of other forms of civil protest? If Canada hosted the Olympics again, would you be arrested as a terrorist for protesting at the Olympics again? Probably you would, based on this legislation. You know, I'd like to go on about this some more, but we are running out of time here on the sector. And I do want to wrap up with a bit more about FunDrive. So again, this link will be on our show notes, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, along with the podcast. So again, take a look at this article, read it over. Perhaps next week or maybe the week after, we'll dive a bit into more of this terrorism legislation that the Harper government is pushing through, essentially as we speak, actually. So yes, we'll maybe touch on that in a week or two. Remember that next week is the CITR Fund Drive, and of course, I encourage you to donate to CITR. It helps keep shows like The Sector on, but it also helps keep CITR on. And all the great programming that happens on the station, all the great content, the news, the music, the civil disobedience, if you will, it helps it keep it around. And if that's something that's important to you, please, please consider donating. You can do so by a number of different ways. You can visit CITR.ca and donate online. You can also pledge on the air or off air if you prefer. You can call 604-822-8648 or 604-UBC-UNIT. And we'll be giving out that number a lot next week when we do our special pledge drive episode. So stay tuned for that, of course. And if you want to donate, you can do it so online, in person, over the phone. We accept cash, check, or money order, Visa or MasterCard, or monthly direct deposit. So again, helping CITR is a big deal. It does make a difference. You know, it's not just a drop in the bucket for us. It actually does have a tangible impact on what we're able to produce, what kind of content we can make, and where we can take the station. So I really do encourage you to donate. As I said, next week I'll be doing a special episode of The Sector / Radio Free Thinker Tuesday at 3 o'clock with my good buddy Don McLennigan. And we'll be asking for donations. We'll be talking a bit about skepticism, social justice, nonprofits, and just kind of tag teaming the whole process. It should be a lot of fun, so I hope you'll tune in. In the meantime, this has been episode 37 of The Sector. Be sure to check out sectorpodcast.wordpress.com for the podcast show notes and any other linkage of importance that you can find in relation to today's episode or past episodes, of course. You can subscribe to the podcast at citr.ca. And the next time that you hear me on the radio will be on Tuesday, March 3rd, for our Fun Drive special with me and Don talking about The Sector and Radio Free Thinker. So tune in then, and that'll be in a few days. So everybody, have a great weekend. Take care, and thank you for tuning in to The Sector. Stay tuned, because Up on the Roof is next. We all want to change the world. Tell me that it's evolution. Destruction.